Müller House Meeting, Thursday morning, April 3rd, 1975.
Adam, where art thou? This was the question asked by the Lord in the Garden of Eden, after Adam had eaten of the so-called forbidden fruit. Adam is the name for all mankind. One of its meanings is that which is made out of the ground not meaning just the earth and the soil, but the ground as the origin of all things, is the German word Erdgrund. Erdgrund, that's it. That's the meaning. Made of the ground. It also means the firmament. And it also means the ultimate creative life pulse in the blood. Aleph stands for that life pulse, and Dam means the blood. These are the meanings of Adam. And these meanings apply to each and every human being on the globe right through the ages, and will continue to mean that until Adam truly represents the original Yahweh Elohim, which is the creative pulse together with the great evolutionary process which embodies that life pulse and comes to fruition through the human being, each individual human being. So the story of Adam is the story of you and of me. It doesn't apply to something which happened a long time ago in the past to one or two particular individuals. It is one of the profoundest myths which is the heritage of the entire Judeo-Christian tradition. Now this question, Adam, where art thou, was asked in the cool of the evening. It's very significant. The cool of the evening, after Adam had eaten of the fruit. And the evening is the time when one enters into a state of some degree of quietude before the mortal mind slides into the perfect rest and stillness of the unknown divine mind, which is the night and sleep. But when the mortal wakes up from sleep, although he wakes up refreshed psychophysically, if he has slept well, he loses any sort of awareness of that transcendent reality in which he rested, without hindering it, without obstructing it, through the hours of sleep. And so, the Lord asks this question, and Yahweh is translated as Lord, Elohim is translated as God in the translations of the Old Testament. Yahweh is this divine immanence within ourselves, within each and every one of us. This mysterious power which without compulsion draws us, almost compels us, if we are the least bit sensitive, to so grow in inner awareness that the divine will gets fulfilled through man. Now that is in us, just as in the Hindu tradition and in the yogic tradition, it is taught that Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, the creative power which brings the universe into being and then reabsorbs it in its dissolution. Shiva resides in us, ourselves, and Shiva's point of contact with the mortal body is symbolically represented as through the brain, through the head. Shiva resides here. Like that. So now, before sliding into this state of rest, the question is asked not by some external God. It's asked by one's own innermost awareness of transcendence, dimly stirring, dimly waking up. It asks, "Where art thou?" Now try and follow all this meditatively. Don't follow it logically, intellectually only, but meditatively, with the mind quiet. This question then arises from within us because that transcendent reality is embodied totally in the whole organism, and it comes to consciousness in the brain. And so before falling asleep, when the brain ceases to be in a state of turmoil because of the activities of everyday life, the distractions of everyday life, as this quietness steals upon your being, the question is asked, "Where art thou?" And what is the meaning of this question? Remember, it is asked in the stillness. And the stillness does not use words. In the stillness, consciousness sinks more and more into its own realm, which is unknown by the analytical intellect and the brain. And that question, so to say, permeates the whole psychophysical being. Where art thou? Meaning, at what level of consciousness are you now? Are you in the state of communion with the supreme within yourself? The eternal within yourself. Are you in the state of communion? Or have you been captivated, enraptured by the world of sensation, which deals with the world of particulars only, unrelated to each other, and therefore liable to conflict and sorrow. This is the meaning of the question. Adam ate the fruit, not as ordinarily understood of the tree of good and evil. He ate the fruit of the tree of life. Remember, there are statements in the first chapters of Genesis which mislead everybody. The tree of life was planted in the middle of the garden. And then it is said that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was also planted in the middle of the garden. If both trees were in the middle of the garden, they must be one and only tree. Consider what is the fruit of the tree of life for you, for me, human beings. That fruit is the supreme state of consciousness, samadhi, as we call it in Sanskrit. The supreme awareness, which is the state of uninterrupted and continuous communion with the total reality. The state in which I no longer resist the will of the supreme, the unknown supreme, whatever that is. That is the fruit. But when this psychophysical organism is given of that fruit and it eats it, it is not yet prepared for this supreme communion. The psychophysical being is ignorant, subject to his desires, confused within himself, a blind child of mortality still. And so, something goes wrong in the eating of that fruit. When I pluck of the fruit, I myself do it. When I pluck of the fruit of the tree of life, I scar the tree, I hurt the tree, spoil the tree. And it becomes converted into the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as we call it. So you see, our task is to wake up to the full meaning of this fruit, ultimately. Who gives me of that fruit? Not Eve, the mother of all living, Heva. It is Esha, the woman. God makes the woman. Elohim makes the woman and presents the woman to man, the male. Esh. Esh is the male. Esha is the female. And this This Esha refers to the divine androgyne, the male-female in one, and the divine female represents, as far as we are concerned, that supreme aspiration, that indescribable urge towards something totally beyond us, which is absolutely wonderful and marvelous, and which we cannot help but obey sometime or other in our life. Now we know how in our lives we always get moments when the mind is a little bit calm, we are fully awake, and we become aware of this mysterious something, and we feel as if we are moving towards that divinity. And then the stimuli of the outer world shut that up, spoil that state, and we are back again having just tasted a little bit of that fruit. Just a little bit of that fruit. And so, all that is left to us when we are back again in the turmoil of everyday life is a discriminative consciousness only, which calls this good and that bad. This which is pleasant I call good, that which is unpleasant I call bad. And that's where all the trouble begins. The dualism, the ambivalence begins. And the state of the one total integrated reality is split up into conflicting particulars. So, Adam, where art thou? It is our business to understand this and return to our eternal home in every state of consciousness, whether we are awake, whether we are tired, whether we are asleep, or wherever we are. We have to regain the utterly pure, sinless state. This is the great task before man. Now, I said in our little gathering last night that we will try to learn together meditatively. I have already suggested this morning to let the mind be quiet and just dwell upon that which is presented to the mind. Now, letting the mind be quiet like that, let us consider one or two very important points. What do we mean by meditation? Meditation is the English word used to stand for what in Sanskrit we call samadhi. Samadhi really means the state of uninterrupted, perfect communion all 24 hours of the day. The state of supreme, unbreakable communion. That is samadhi. It is characterized by perfectly awakened, enlightened attentiveness. Now here, one has to be particularly meditative in trying to understand this. Attentiveness is the eternal condition of the supreme creative energy of the universe. It is perpetually attentive. But it doesn't attend to a particular object. Now this must be understood very clearly. When I try to attend to a particular object, I am self-conscious and separate from the object. I cannot attend to the object in itself, ever. What I am actually attending to is my particular mental idea, my mental construct of the object. If and when I have reached that state of utter purification, utter transparency of the mind, then All my mental constructs are dissolved. And when I look at the object, I see the object in itself, which seeing is quite indescribable in words. Because all the vocabularies of the world are built up out of our mental constructs of our sense experience of the world, and not because our senses have functioned absolutely freely and have known the reality which is the world. So, attentiveness in this profound religious sense is not attending to a particular object, attending to a particular person, or to an idea, or to any teaching, or to any pronouncement, however sacred, however profound. Now you see, in the teachings of the Upanishads, for instance, the ultimate reality, Brahman, is called Sat, Chit, Ananda. Being, that is one total being, that is Sat, Chit, which is absolute consciousness. And the intellect can never conceive what absolute consciousness is. Nothing absolute can ever be conceived by the intellect. But it is absolute consciousness and bliss. Ananda, bliss. That mysterious, unknown harmony of the totality, which I, as an ordinary mortal, cannot see. I say, look at the stars, the great galaxies in their collisions, what terrible things happen, I say. Look at wars, look at this, look at the other, and what terrible things they are. Yes, relatively to me, the limited mortal. But if you or I were in complete communion with the totality, which part of it shall we say is terrible, and which part shall we say is agreeable? It is all the one reality. I myself, the Ehyye, I am, as pronounced by the Lord God to Moses when the bush was burning in the wilderness. I am Ehyye, Asher Ehyye. I am that I am, the total I am. Nothing is rejected. Nothing needs to be accepted. Because it is all part and parcel of the one reality. Therefore, there is no question of either acceptance or rejection. So, this Sat, Chit, Ananda. Now, this Chit, this absolute consciousness, is obviously the state not of discriminative, analytical consciousness. It is that attentive, alert condition. The truly all-knowing condition. All-knowing because it is that which it knows. This is the important point. So now, meditation means to be in the state of complete attentiveness. There are all sorts of implications involved in this, which we will go into a little bit on another occasion. Very good. Now obviously, such a state means, that is to say, when an individual is in such a state, he is the receptacle, the cup, if you like, the Holy Grail, if you like to use that term. He is the grail of transcendence, into whom pours that eternal, unknown, unknowable spirit, the mystery, all the time. It is a cup which has no restrictions, which has no boundaries. It has no bottom. It has no sides. We use the word cup because it is a convenient word. So you are in that state where you are totally unresisting in consciousness to all the energies, the creative energies that pulsate throughout the universe. And that is the state of attentiveness. Now you see, obviously, there is no meaning then in true meditation to attend to a particular object or thought or person or anything. These are all the kindergarten stages. They have to be gone through, of course. But I mention, as far as I am capable of presenting to you, the supreme, because then we'll know which way we are traveling. And of course, traveling is an inadequate word, because traveling means a particular direction. Here there is no particular direction. It is into the totality. That is why whatever road you travel on in the spiritual sense, provided this inner urge is the pure transcendent urge itself, the total reality becomes the fact for you. That is why Sri Krishna said, on whatsoever path a man approaches me, on that path do I meet him. Krishna representing the one total reality. So it is important that we understand, or at least try to understand, in its innermost depth, the meaning of meditation and what it means, therefore, to live meditatively. What are the obstructions to this meditative state? I'll just briefly mention them now. We might deal with them in a little more detail on another occasion. The obstructions are, first and foremost, our own mental and physical conditioning, our particular beliefs, our ideas, our conceptions, our desires. All these represent the way in which our primordial life energy is constricted, restricted, made into something finite and torn away from the body of the total life. All these constitute our psychical and psycho-mental processes and phenomena inside ourselves. And they are the obstructions, because when we start, we are ignorant of the fact. We are unconscious of the fact, unaware of it, that there is only one total reality, and all these have to be related to that total reality. We treat them as separate. That is why we quarrel with each other over ideas. Oh no, I believe this, your belief is wrong. My idea is this, it is better than your idea, and so on and so on. But consider how our own ordinary life teaches us the reverse. Those of us who are parents, we know how the little one, when it grows up and begins to have, as we say, a mind of its own, it generally starts by thinking father and mother don't know and starts arguing. I did it myself as a little child. And I can still see my father just looking at me, smiling gently and saying, yes, sonny, yes, sonny. He knew that in course of time this would change. this first egoistic drive, it would change. You see? So now, these are the obstructions in the way of that perfect attentiveness. Now, supposing the obstructions were not there, and perfect attentiveness is there, what is the complement, psychophysically and psychospiritually, of that attentiveness? The complement is love in its supreme reality. In my worldly state, love is an infatuation, a being enamored, a passion, an emotion, a delight, a pain, an intoxication, a madness, so long as I am in my worldly state. Is there love where there is envy, jealousy, possessiveness, exclusiveness, comparison, ambition, dependence, conditionality, sorrow, pining for the beloved, increase, decrease, or any demand whatsoever? But there are those unconscious, unself-conscious moments when a magic thrills the heart and sweeps my whole being clean. And then there is no division between you and me. Indeed, I do not see an other when I see you. Indeed, there is no me that can prove to be an other. A little later, the spell is gone, but the flash of the vision stays as a memory of the beatitude of that which is beyond me, and lives in my soul as a flaming pointer to the reality of divine love. In the pure state, in mind space, which is the meaning of the word akasha, which is both the limitless void and the conditioned fullness, and in the untrammeled awareness wherein is the transcendent energy which is creative action in eternity, the sacred mystery of love is realized. So it becomes known here in our everyday life that love was never born, love never grows nor dies. Love is. God, transcendence, is the living love that lights the flame of life in the world and in me. Let me never cover love with thought, with memory. Eros has wings of gold, and if I let love soar freely through all the void, I die in ecstasy in every living moment of me, the embodied transcendence. And also, like Eros, I soar beyond the sorrow of dying in agony in every moment of clinging memory. Love, the great compassion, Maha Karuna, is actively present in the timeless infinite. The Holy One loves. I, the worldling, sentimentalize. At best, I can touch romantic love at its finest. In the purified holy state, I can let the power of love heal and sanctify all through me as the instrument, whether it be in the form of the divine abidings, as they are called in Buddhist terminology, or intercessionary prayer, or any other chosen form. I here know not what love is, and never can know. This is with reference to the transcendent reality of love. It can never be known by the mind. It cannot be framed. If it can be framed, it is something small, petty, particular. It will come into being, make its little stir, and die. Seeking to know by thought or sensation, that is, carnally, or seeing the semblance of love, immediately banishes this transcendent love. Eros awoke when a drop of hot oil fell on him as he lay asleep and disappeared. Eros represents the supreme creative power in action, which is the love of God, which, like the love, the peace of God, passeth all understanding. Eros disappeared, and Psyche suffered long agony. You all know the Greek myth of Eros and Psyche. And yet in truth, this transcendent love is all around me, in me, and flows freely through me. Infinite, invisible, one, peaceful, blissful, creative. If I love as the Holy One loves, all evil is overcome. No, not overcome, but transformed into immortal beauty by transcendent love. Love is love. Immediacy of eternity. Nothing to do with time and its movement. Here now. The eternal now. Timeless throb of the unknown. Blessedness of beatitude. The numinous no thing. God. This word numinous was used very effectively by Rudolf Otto in his work, I think, Der Heilige. And he talked of the numinous quality of the presence of God. And such is love. Now, I hope it has been possible to listen meditatively. Let me just point out one or two things here. We, as we are, haven't developed the faculty of meditative listening, meditative looking, touching, tasting, feeling, and so on. You will find that the mind, as it looks, as it hears, is always talking back at what it sees or hears. It's always talking back at it, agreeing or disagreeing, liking or disliking. This is the non-meditative state. The meditative state is where the mind is quiet, at peace. It just lets the whole world come into oneself. And it doesn't do anything to it. It just is alert. It is conscious. It is aware. And in that state, whatsoever comes is transformed into the perfect within your consciousness. Now, this is the meaning of learning in the profound religious sense. This is how the disciples of ancient days learned from the master, from their teacher. And you appreciate that this was the state of communion between what in those days was called teacher and pupil, master and disciple. Listening this way, seeing this way, the inner spiritual reality grows. And when oneself has become the pure man, the sinless Adam, then within oneself all the evil and sorrow of existence is transformed into perfection, is purified. And you are the center, like the sun, from which radiates the benediction of the divine upon the whole world around you.